And welcome to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Linda Jager. Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be talking with Jim Strauss. He's the director of the premiere, The Incredible Jessica James. Later on in the hour, we'll be talking with the directors of Last Men in Aleppo, Ferris Fayyad and Steen Johansen. The director of The Last Word, Mark Pellington, will be joining us, along with screenwriter Stuart Ross. And finally, something I'm looking forward to, we'll be talking with director Rory Kennedy and the subject of her new film, Laird Hamilton, with the documentary premiere, Take Everywhere. If you're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
The Sundance Reel is brought to you in part by Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience.
And welcome back. And I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Linda Jager, today. We've got our Friday film reviewers joining us here for the next week. So welcome and thanks again for coming back.
Good morning. Happy snowy Monday.
All right. So as your job with Park City, you had a busy weekend. What just with the march? You had a panel on Main Street yesterday?
We did, actually. A very busy weekend. So I am starting my movie viewing today. I did catch the premiere opening Inconvenience sequel, which was amazing. Really great to start the festival off with that, as well as with the new climate theme this year. So it was very appropriate. I really liked it. But yes, busy weekend. March, just thanks to everyone. I think it went very smoothly. Great participants, and they were great about loading in, loading out. Everyone carpooled. Everyone took the buses. It went really well.
Yeah, so. And some of us took the buses and got out of the buses and
figured
we could just walk faster.
I heard. And we got everybody there, so.
Yeah, and as I was walking back down, noticed I probably walked by several hundred people who were coming up, and these were folks just kind of stranded on I-80, I think.
Yeah, it was really tough with snow conditions and road closures and so forth on I-80, but definitely a great turnout. I think we're estimating between 8 and 10,000 that were there, and a very peaceful and respectful event, protests and so forth, so I think it went well.
Yeah, so. Interesting, so because I've heard the count 4,000 to 8,000, now we're hearing 8 to 10.
I heard 8 immediately after from police department, and I've been hearing upwards of 10, so I definitely think we're safe to say between 8 and 10,000.
All right, so what's on your list of things to go see then?
Well, I am very excited. I'm actually looking forward to catching some of the films that we're talking about today. The Last Word, I think, is up quickly. Ingrid Goes West is one that's on my schedule for the week. That's about a blogger and a fan of the blogger that goes out to sort of live that lifestyle and follow her. Fun Mom Dinner will definitely be a fun one as well. Rumble, Band-Aid. I love Fred Armiston, so I'm looking forward to seeing that one. The Hulk Hogan documentary with his case in the press. That will be really interesting. So quite a few. I'm catching as I can. So
yeah, let's talk real briefly about also the panel that Sundance, I think, reached out to Park City Municipal before the panel they held with Amy Goodman and, boy, some fascinating speakers down at Base Camp yesterday afternoon.
Absolutely.
But we put on kind of our local panel?
We did, and we were thrilled that Sundance made that opportunity available and invited us to participate. We actually brought in four panelists to showcase our local sustainability efforts. So we had Luke Carton, who's my colleague up at Park City Municipal, who heads our environmental sustainability team, Mary Krista Smith from Summit Community Powerworks, Peter Metcalf from Black Diamond, definitely vocal supporter in the state, and then Christopher Nelson with the Georgetown University Energy Prize, which is actually a program we're participating in. It's a $5 million grant that we've been competing for the last year and a half. So we're hoping to have some good news when that wraps up next summer, spring. And it was really fascinating to just share all the things that we're doing here, things from, you know, our electric vehicles and solar use, all the great work that Summit Community Powerworks has been doing with their Switch Stories campaign. So there's definitely a groundswell in support, and I think we're a model community for our sustainability efforts.
And I'm working on a story about that, but I think one of the most interesting things I heard is that, you know what, if we can do it here with mountains and snow, we can do it anywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, things are happening at the local level, and we've seen that. So we're excited to cheer that on.
And also just been given in a climate that really supports the fossil fuel industry.
Exactly. Luke brought out yesterday, coal is the official rock of Utah, I believe. So it's interesting, definitely.
We have an Olympic mascot, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be back with our first guest. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com.
And it's 9:12. Good morning. Well, just a heads up, again, we had some very slow-moving traffic. Park City Police have closed Upper Marsac Avenue, so please take Royal Street if you're headed to Upper Deer Valley. You can still get to the China Bridge parking garage, but it closes right there at Hillside. Well, one of the closing night films for Sundance 2017 is a film by Jim Strauss. He's been to Sundance three times already, and he's back this year with the film The Incredible Jessica James. Good morning to you. Let me get your mic up here, the right mic, let's put it that way. So tell us first, who is Jessica James and why is she so incredible?
Jessica James is a character played by Jessica Williams. She's a young, struggling writer who's trying to break into theater. She's incredible just because she doesn't stop. She doesn't give up. I consider, in a strange way, this movie kind of my superhero movie, but it's about an ordinary person. She works for a nonprofit theater organization helping kids write and produce plays from public schools. And she just is once you see the movie, you'll know why I think she's incredible. She just sort of speaks her mind and is really just a fiercely honest person.
Well, so she's played by Jessica Williams, somebody you've used as a supporting actress in your last film, People, Places, and Things. So did you cast for the role, or you just knew that Jessica was Jessica?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a huge fan of Jessica Williams. I always have been since she first appeared on The Daily Show. And I also am a fan of her stand-up with Phoebe Robinson. She does this incredible podcast called Two Dope Queens. Mm-hmm. I've always been a fan. When I got a chance to work with her on People, Places, Things, my fandom turned into friendship, and from there it sort of grew into this idea for a project, kind of just centered around her. I wrote the thing for her. There was no one else. It wouldn't have worked with anyone else.
I see with your last film here, People's Places and Things, and then this film, there's a lot of common theme about just heartbreak and transition. And is that kind of carried through, or is that inspiration obviously for your second film here?
It is. Mm-hmm. This is also a story like the last one. This is a story about kind of relationships, the end of relationships, and it's about Jessica. One thing the film is about is getting over a relationship. That's so I guess that is a theme that carries through two things. I think I'm kind of becoming an expert in romantic failure. I think similarly to People, Places, Things, this is a story full of good-hearted people just making silly mistakes. Mm-hmm. And then having to figure out how to undo them and learn from them.
Now, the film takes place setting in Brooklyn. Was that sort of a given immediately? Did you know that's where you wanted to
the story? I've been in New York for almost 20 years. I have two kids there. There's like practical reasons and creative reasons for setting stuff in Brooklyn. Practical, because I live there and I have two kids there. Mm-hmm. But the creative reasons it felt right for the... it's the world I know, and for her ambition as a playwright, I don't think this, like, the idea of New York being the place you have to go to make it is the same as it used to be when I actually moved to New York. But as far as the theater aspect of things go, I think New York is actually an important destination. So that's why I kept it there as opposed to, I do think we as film, I know a lot of filmmakers who live in Brooklyn, we need to go other places. We need to explore the rest of the world and country. But for this particular story, it worked.
So as I mentioned, I mean, it's one of the closing films for Sundance. So you haven't had a public screening at this point?
We had a volunteer screening on Thursday. So I've been here for a while. But it doesn't officially premiere until Friday, closing night. It'll be the closing night film at Eccles.
Right. So what was the reaction then with the volunteers?
It was a really fun screening. You know, it was nice to be, it was nice to have that chance to show the film because I would have been very anxious all week if I didn't have a chance to watch the movie with an audience until Friday. It was a great opportunity to share it with the volunteers. I've been to Sundance a couple of times and I know how hard they work. I know that this festival would not be able to run without them. So hopefully they liked it. They seemed to like it. I felt great responsibility to entertain them.
Yeah. So Jessica Williams, of course, one of the presenters at the Women's March on Saturday morning. Were you there for that?
I was there. I was tearing up. I thought that
she's amazing.
Yeah. Jessica's an amazing speaker, and she's just an amazing person. Her mind is really wonderful. And I was just, I was moved to tears. She's so passionate, and the content of what she had to say was so beautiful and inspiring. It made a dark day a little better, I think, for a lot of people.
Well, I think at, 27? Is that all she is, really?
Yeah.
She just seemed so much wiser beyond her years. So
yeah.
I'm impressed because I'm not familiar with her then. Well, let's talk just a little bit about, in the couple minutes that we have left, what about the life of an independent filmmaker? I mean, as I mentioned, you'd been here three times before. You're obviously making a living at it.
Well, it's not easy. My fellow indie filmmakers would agree. It's hard to make a living making the types of movies that I'm interested in because they rely on smaller budgets and smaller budgets means less money for everyone. So I have to supplement filmmaking with teaching and odd jobs here and there. I love the life I have, and it's a freelance life. I teach some years it's teaching more than writing or directing. It's just I never know what the year is going to be like. It's always like a little bit of a hustle, but I wouldn't want anything else.
Were you teaching at a college?
I teach at the School of Visual Arts. I've taught at NYU, all over New York.
Yeah, so you just kind of apply when there's an opening for a course. It's kind of up and down in terms of what classes you're teaching.
School of Visual Arts has been my mainstay. I've been routinely, most years I'll teach like three classes there. But it ebbs and flows, you know, because work will come here and there, and then I don't have to teach as much.
Yeah. What's next for you now after you've completed this film?
I'm go back to more parenting responsibilities and writing. I write all the time. I write, I write for work, and I also write for on a spec level. Just mm-hmm. I really. So that's most likely parenting writing.
Parenting inspiring a future film for you?
My kids inspire everything for sure. Mm-hmm. Having kids really made my writing life just so much richer and my life in general. But the kids have been an inspiration behind everything.
Good. Well, we've been talking to the director of the premiere, the closing film, The Incredible Jessica James, Jim Strauss. He's got some screenings coming up towards the end of the week. First one on Friday night, 6:15 at the Eccles. Actually a great time to try and get in the film there. And then again, Saturday morning, the 28th at 9 a.m. at the Eccles. And then you'll be in Salt Lake at the Grand Theater on Sunday. The best of luck to you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchford from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
It's 9:22. Again, we've got some weather out there and reports of traffic backup. You can always let Ethel know with the latest. We had heard reports of very slow-moving traffic on both 224 and 248, both ways into Park City. Marsac Avenue has been closed by the Park City Police, so if you need to get to Upper Deer Valley, you'll need to take Royal Street. Otherwise, Marsac is closed there at Hillside Avenue. Well, one of the entries in the World Cinema documentary competition is the film Last Men in Aleppo. In the studio to tell us more about the film, I have the directors of the film, Faris Fayed and Steen Johansson. He also edited the film. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So who wants to start? Begin by just telling us what the film is about, since neither of us have seen it.
Yeah.
Faris?
The film, it's tell the story about one of the biggest city in Syria. It's called Aleppo, and specific about a character from a group from volunteer they called White Helmets, which is known for the word in this name. In they called in Syria between the people Syrian civil defense. And the story is specific about two characters from this, the group, and we have followed this is two characters and working on all this is film like about around 2 years and trying from this is two characters to tell the story about the whole conflict and the human situation in Syria from their relation and from the thing that they do it behind the war, not just about the war. There is a lot of stories behind the war.
Yeah. Are you from Syria, Faris?
I'm Syrian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm living now in because I'm forced to leave my country, so I'm living now in Germany.
Forced to leave your country,
yeah.
Just given the war, or because of the films you're making, or
I was arrested before by the Syrian regime, and I like around 8 months and. Three times, and the third times I just like he kept following me, and I leave, I forced to leave because I will be killed if I stay in Syria, and then I couldn't back again even because ISIS also they control a lot of places. So who's forced me? Syrian regime, Assad Syrian regime, and ISIS, both of them.
Because of your work.
Yeah, of my work as a filmmaker.
So now how did the two of you find out? Because, Steen, you're from Denmark?
Denmark, yes. So we were connected. Firas had been working on the film, and we work with some photographers that are in Aleppo from something called Aleppo Media Center, some young guys that are very talented and had been shooting on the street for a long time, but were tired of sending out news reports because that's what they were doing. You know, the bombs fall, they run out. Film people, make an interview, send it to Reuters, CNN, these kind of news outlets. And then they were tired of the situation because nothing changed. You know, the bombs kept falling. And And that there was a Danish NGO or international NGO that put us together, and we made a workshop where Firas came and the photographers came across the border to Turkey, and we met there. And that's how basically we met. I mean, Firas had been working in Denmark before, so I also knew him before this, but that's how I came into the project.
Yeah.
How did you find there are three white helmets that you focus on in the film? How did you connect with them specifically?
I have met like many our witnesses with I was very close from the work of this is white helmets, like from the beginning of their establishment the project with the leader of the white helmets. He's called Raed Saleh, and I know most of the young guys who is working, because it's meaning young guys, they are, I'm talking about a young between 21 to 29 up to 30 after like 3 years from the upgoing the war. So I was know some of them, and I was like trying to follow them with meeting them, and we chose like with a conversation like a six character from them, which is like specific. They have like they are normal people, they doesn't have like this is like from intellectual people and the normal citizen who decide to stay in Syria, who decide to not take the weapon, who decide to save the civilians, who doesn't have this is like a strong political opinion, which is like we need to tell about the story about the civilians, not just as a white helmets, as a people, as a real people in there. And then we start to following them, and the three characters give us more the feeling of the this is our character. And of course, with the editing, we come the conversation me and Steen to like make the story sharp more afterwards.
So how dangerous was it for you to be there, filming this?
Actually, me and Steen, we didn't been there. I been there before this story. I do like different documentaries for the televisions and different things, and white helmets are for the Raed Saleh. But I was directing this is a story from distance, and I was trying. I was like connecting with a camera cinematographer, which is they are super talented and brave. They have this is like a decision. We wanna do this story. We wanna make these things, and they have a belief in the art and the role of the cinema, which is that's not easy to do it, especially if they are coming up from journalistic side. And all of this is like conversation we create together, the style of the films and the story of the films.
The Steen, yeah, will about the danger. I mean. We established a big uplink, so they can, you know, they even in the middle of the war they could send out the images and the footage. So on a daily basis they upload and we can watch it and discuss it, and then Firas gives feedback to them. That's how it, kind of the back and forth. And so it's been a very it's been complicated to, you know, sit there and you can do nothing and see all these images coming in. And you know how, you can see how dangerous it is. If you see the film, you can see there's, all the time situations arise where not just the characters, but also the photographers like, it's very dangerous. Yeah.
What surprised you most about the characters? You mentioned before they're civilians, so balancing their I think I was reading in some of the notes that a lot of them weren't sharing with their families what they were doing. What surprised you?
I think what surprised me was, on the forefront, they come out as they are heroes. I mean, that's just how it is. But the kind of the levels of reflections that they have behind doing what they're doing and the complexities that they deal with and how complex it is, because they have to shuffle, you know, they have families there and kids there. And of course, when they choose to do this work, they risk their family's life and their own life. So the choice is not just themselves. It's many, many things. And that I mean, the complexity of it, that surprised me, I think.
Well, is there anything left there besides ISIS and the Syrian army? I mean, hasn't everybody moved out at this point?
I want to mention this. In Aleppo, there is no ISIS because a lot of people, they confused about this. They think there is ISIS. ISIS is around in the countryside of Aleppo, which is like far from the city. And the Syrian regime tried many times to, with the Russian propaganda, they tried many times to tell that there is ISIS there because they want to make for themselves a reason to bomb Aleppo and destroy it.
Justifies the bombing.
Yeah, it destroyed Aleppo. And in Aleppo, that it's controlled by rebels, Syrian regime, and the Kurdish militaries, three parties. And the rebels, there is like many parties in the rebels. There is like from them, of course, like extremes, but not terrorists, not on the list of the terrorists, which is like a civilians who is angry and they use like the religion as a part from their goal to defense themselves and to feel that they are safe from around them. And other, they are Free Syrian Army, which is like, this is some group from the Syrian regime army who was divided and they didn't decide not fighting, killing the people. And the civilians, which is, this is the big part in Aleppo, which is they trying to fight for the life, finding their daily life. Apart from them, a white helmet, which is, was like the most of this is people who is like make the people believe in their daily lives and trust. I'm talking about the trust because it's something very horrible and hard in Syria to have it. And with this is people, the people start to establish the trust.
Is that why this film was important to be made?
Yes.
Because of that?
One of this is the reason that this is film is stand in is the trust. We established this is film about the trust with the character, with the cameraman. And we established this is film because we want to tell the people how much this is work of this is white helmets. It's important for the society, not just because they saving a children, which is important, but also about the meaning of the hope, meaning about the work that make the people continue their life and not leave their countries and not make like a mass of refugees to Europe or to any other countries. A people, they decide because when you find your children or somebody from your family under the rubble and this is people they sacrifice in their soul and they pull it, you believe that, yes, I want to continue here. I want to do this work. I want to join them because there is the hope here under the ground with their hand.
This may be outside of your realm of politics, but I'm just wondering if you had heard this and trying to get your reaction to it. I mean, we had one of our U.S. presidential candidates being asked what he would do about Aleppo, and here in the classic deer in the headlights on TV, live TV, he didn't have a clue, and it was like, what's Aleppo? I mean, does that concern you at all in terms of a man aspiring to be the most powerful position in our country, not knowing what's going on in Aleppo?
I feel, of course, this. I mean, it's that's embarrassing for him. But I mean, you know, I'm from Copenhagen, and everybody, you know, if you could walk around here and say from Copenhagen, oh, the capital in Scandinavia. I mean, there's many people who doesn't know. But of course, this man should be an educated person and. You would think that he would know because it's been on in front of the media for like a long time now. So of course, yes, embarrassing.
I think. And of course, I mean, for him, like asking about a city, it's like kind of outside of any thinking about the meaning of to be political. Then you are sitting behind the microphone and you didn't know what's going on behind in the other side from the war. Which is like a big war happened and your country involved in this war and you didn't know what's going on in one of biggest city in the Middle East. And like every day there is like around 10 to 15% of the civilians killed. And that of course, I mean, it's, sometimes it's like you look to these things, it's like a surprise or something, it's kind of closing the eyes. Maybe he know. But he didn't want to know.
Well, we need to leave it there. Again, let's go through a quick rundown. You've got a screening today, 2:45 at the Yarrow Hotel. Let's see. On Tuesday, it'll be in Salt Lake. Back here Wednesday at Prospector Square at 2:45. Thursday at the Holiday Village. And then a final screening on Friday night at Redstone Cinema. Best of luck to you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We've been talking with the director and editor of the film Last Men in Aleppo. This is the Sundance Reel on KPCW.
This is Eric Lee, attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo. As a Park City resident for 20 years, I'm proud to support KPCW. Jones Waldo provides legal services to residents of Summit County in many areas. 435-200-0085. JonesWaldo.com.
One of the premieres playing in this year's festival is The Last Word. It stars Shirley MacLaine, so it's got to be fun and sassy in the studio with us. I have the director of The Last Word, Mark Pellington, along with the screenwriter, Stuart Ross. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for having us.
So, Stuart, you want to start then and just kind of give us some of the background, the plot of the film?
Sure, I would love to. Thank you. Thanks for having us. It's a story about a woman who is sort of a lifelong control freak. She definitely would not like that term. And now, at the end of her life, she realizes there's one last thing left to control, and that's her obituary. And she wants to make sure it's perfect and exactly the way she wants to be remembered. So she hires a local writer, played by Amanda Seyfried, to pen her obituary. And when the first draft does not meet her extremely lofty expectations, she sets out to rewrite her life story with Amanda's character and a few others dragged along for the ride.
Yeah. So any reference to this personally for you? I mean, do you know somebody like Harriet, I think her name is?
Oh, yes, I'm sure we've all met people in our lives who are very controlling. I'm sure I have those tendencies as well. But no one exactly like her. She is an original.
And the two of you have worked together before? Or?
Yeah, we actually met in the world of advertising. Stuart was a creative director for an ad agency, and I was a commercial director. And he, you know, a few years ago, he goes, "I've got an idea for a movie." Told me the idea. I said, "It's a good idea. Write it." He graciously hired me 6 months later, I think, just to come out to L.A. for us to work on the screenplay. Gave me the screenplay. We worked on it for about a year. And with Anne-Marie McKay, my partner in our commercial company, we optioned it, worked on it for a bit. And then, you know, get the script up to the stage where you think it's in good shape to start approaching actors and go through that game of actors and financing. And it came together pretty quickly for the, you know, for the normal indie movie. And we landed on Shirley. Shirley was somebody that Stuart really had sought out early on top of our wish list. You know, we took a swing at some people. You know, there's only so many people that can, you know, in that age range, you know, let's say 75 plus, but some great, great, great classic, you know, thespians. And when Shirley said yes, Amanda signed on, and we took it from there.
Yeah, how was it to work with Shirley? The outside looking in, she looks like a fabulous person, but right?
She is. She's exactly in my mind, she was exactly what I thought she would be. She's Shirley MacLaine. But what I didn't realize was, until I met her and watched her work with Mark, was really how smart she was. I mean, if you've been doing this for a long time, I mean, she knew everything going on. I mean, she was really together, really knew her line. She was fantastic.
She knew more than the AD. AD would say, she'd say, how long to the next shot? And the AD would say, you know, maybe 15 minutes. She goes, come on. Okay, 25. I was, Shirley was, as he said, everything that you would expect. Incredibly smart, incredibly just a real no bullshit person. You know, like a real straight up, just you really got to have your game together. You know, that's what she respects. That's what all real movie stars respect, is like, you just got to have your act together.
So not necessarily tough and unyielding as she is as her character.
Oh, no.
It's like a different, you know, she came from a generation of a way of making movies, and movies now move faster, you know, little indie movies shooting digitally. You know, you have to do in 25 days what maybe in the old days they would do in 40. Do you know what I mean? These old movies, The Graduate, Terms of Endearment, these Paper Moon. I had a dinner with Peter Bogdanovich. He's like, yeah, we shot 75 days. I'm like, that movie would be 20 days, mm-hmm. $2 million now. That's just the way it is. So actors have to kind of shift to that. Actors have to kind of know that we're going to do 4 pages in a day, or you're going to have to like keep the camera rolling and do 3 in a row and get out of there. So she rolled with it. She really liked it. She really, really, really dug that, because it forced her to be in the moment. And she's an incredibly emotional, intuitive woman. And she really liked what it did to her craft.
Yeah. Any big challenges for you making the film, Mark?
Besides Shirley? You know, I think every movie is a challenge. Every movie is a daunting kind of like empty canvas that you look at. But, you know, you trust the script and you trust the characters. That's what you really have to do, and hire really good people. People are hungry and good craftsmen and collaborate. And we got lucky with weather, you know. Like, sometimes you could go down a rabbit hole of, like, just bad weather, which forces you into making compromises. And we got really lucky, and I'm proud of the movie. It's very entertaining. It's poignant, and it's about something, but it never pushes its kind of like, you know, it doesn't push its depth. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't push it in your face. It's there for you to take what you want, mm-hmm. you know, about mortality or about
your legacy.
Yeah, you know, about those things. But in a way, it's a real female-centric picture that I literally think that is a real crowd pleaser.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of themes, you were here last with I'll Melt With You, and I think common looking back and sort of looking back on their life, but obviously a lot darker than this film.
Certainly.
How is that different for you?
Well, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, I think every movie, certainly I Melt With You, was very personal and expressionistic. This one I had gone through that experience, and not necessarily the most pleasant experience in making it or it coming out, I was able to come out the other side, I think, a little more mature. And so yet those themes were interesting to me, yet telling them through these characters and letting Stuart's story kind of guide it, I kind of said, I'm just going to like take a back seat to it. I'll put the camera in the right place, but it's going to be, I'm just going to let actors act and let it unfold a little more. And so there was a certain growth, I think, from one to the next that I'm excited for people to see.
Yeah, you know? And then Stuart, for those of us who aren't around a film set, I mean, how much does this end product look like what you started with?
Well, I am extremely fortunate, and as I mentioned earlier, I think this is my first film, and I probably had the best experience a first-time writer could ever have. One of the reasons why is because, as Mark said, we're friends. So I stayed at his house during the entire shoot. He had me involved, or had me there, I should say, throughout the entire process. So I was able to learn so much just by sitting back and just watching Mark, watching Shirley and Amanda.
And tweak the script. And adjust. You know, there's adjustments that sometimes you can't make. And, you know, there was some long chunks of stuff that Shirley was like, well, it's maybe. So to have a third person there, I'm a big pro writer. I love having writers on the set. To me, it's born with them. It's not like, hey, kid, give it to me and take it over. You know, it's sharing that. Because sometimes if a writer's like, well, I mean, an actor's like, well, talking about a certain meaning of a phrase or a line, like, it doesn't hurt me. I'm egoless. It doesn't hurt me to have, well, tell her.
Right.
You know, and then you collaborate. And I think the actors like it. I think actors like that, you know, that piece. They want to know at the end of the day direction's coming from one place. Yet if you have to make these adjustments, better to have the writer there.
Well, there was a film playing, Their Finest, that kind of talks. I mean, it's about that, you know, taking place during the 40s, about the whole war filmmaking. It was really quite fascinating in terms
awesome.
Of how. Yeah. Anyway, we need to leave it at this. But any news about the film's future here?
The film is coming out very soon. It's coming out on March 3rd. Bleecker Street is releasing it. It's starting in New York and Los Angeles, and then very quickly expanding to. You know, to Boston and San Francisco and Salt Lake, and it's going to many, many markets. They have very high hopes for it. We hope that if it could drive down the path of Hello, My Name is Doris and movies like that, that are these kind of, you know, again, female-driven adult movies that can find that audience. And, you know, in this day and age with everything going on in the world, just like so people can go get a couple of hours of break from the chaos in the world and just go be entertained and see one of the world's greatest actresses, you know, carry a movie. And she hasn't carried a movie in a long time. So this is really a master class in acting, seeing her, you know, it's Shirley MacLaine.
So you guys going to be in town then through Wednesday at least to do
correct.
The Q&A?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Yes.
Because there's a couple more screenings then. 6:30 p.m. at the Eccles tomorrow and then again 9 a.m. Wednesday morning. Congratulations and thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
All Resort Group is a proud KPCW sponsor of Mountain Money.
All Resort Group provides vans, SUVs, sedans, and Express for Less taxi to move you from Salt Lake to Park City and back, or anywhere you want to go.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
Mark Miller Subaru is a proud supporter of KPCW. Mark Miller Subaru offers a variety of new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subaru wagons, sedans, and SUVs for transporting your family, your dog, and snowboards, skis, and sleds through the snow. Love the experience at Mark Miller Subaru. More information at markmillersubaru.com.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host today, Linda Yeager. Well, as somebody who has spent time at the Abu Ghraib prison to the hills of Appalachia, filmmaker Rory Kennedy returns to Sundance with Take Every Way, The Life of Laird Hamilton. Both Rory Kennedy and Laird Hamilton joining us now in the studio. Great to have you here. Thanks for being with us this morning. We want to mention that Laird has flip-flops on. Is that like
we
your
call
only
them slippers in Hawaii, by the way. So when people say flip-flops, I'm like, what are they talking about? Yeah. Aren't those like in-house shoes?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're tough. Hey, let's talk a little bit. I mean, have you guys known each other long? How did this all come about?
Our mutual friend Paul Speaker came up with the idea of me doing a documentary about Laird about a year and a half ago, and we met and talked about it, and you know, I got to know Laird a bit, and
Rory
his story.
Said, absolutely not.
It's
there's
true.
No way in the world. I'm
initially,
not interested.
initially, but then.
But
what,
we did know each other before
well,
too.
Okay,
we had mutual friends,
okay.
and we knew each other, but not
yes
in the real sense of the word.
Yes, but you know, I wasn't, I mean, I'm not a surfer, and I wasn't so interested in making a surf film, although I love surfing and I think it's really cool. But, you know, so I had to sort of get to know Laird and his story, and pretty quickly I realized there was a really extraordinary film to be made and a story to be shared, and I got very excited about it.
And I got very honored that you got excited.
Thank you.
No, Laird, I'm saying, but because I, you know, for me personally, I, when the first, when Paul first said, you know, Rory Kennedy to, you know, would be a phenomenal to direct the film, I thought, I thought that was a phenomenal idea because of her perspective, looking at it from the outside and not coming in with any kind of, you know, prejudice or judgment or criticism and having like, I know about this, I'll tell it the way I think it should be told. It was more just her, which makes her a great documentarian in general, is her openness to like, let's look and see and try to tell a story that people can relate to.
I want to get to one moment, though, in the film. But just, I mean, in terms of after watching it, was yesterday your first time that you had seen it full through?
With polished. I mean, actually, in its you know, with everything. I mean, I saw one rough cut, which I didn't want us, but they thought I should probably see the film because it was about me. But yes, it was the first time I saw the film.
So is it well represented? Are you well represented in it? I mean, do you feel like it tells the story?
Well, it's my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, but we have to tell it in a certain amount of time. And there's, you know, I mean, I think I rely on the story, you know, the genius storytelling of Rory to tell the story and take the things that are important and focus on them. I mean, you can't have the unadulterated version because that's my life. And that would take 50 something years to tell.
It's always a challenge to reduce somebody's, you know, full life from 50 years to 90 minutes or however long it is.
So. Well, you had some good experience though doing your mom's film.
Yes. Yes. Right. So, you know, but it's always an exciting proposition to follow somebody's life, and I think, you know, with all my films, they sort of unfold as they go, and I don't necessarily know exactly what the story is going in, and you know, this was certainly a fun one to pursue.
Yeah, Laird, you're just...
And I will, to answer your question completely, really, is yes, I'm honored by the film and the storytelling of it, and that, and actually, I was like, it's more interesting maybe than my life was because I stretched it out for so long.
Well, Laird, you've been in other films, both yes. feature and documentaries. Yes. And how was this experience, obviously being all about you? How was that different?
You know, I didn't really look. I mean, because it's archival, so it's a little. That's an aspect of it that's different. It's the truth. It's my life. So it's not like I was trying to pretend to be somebody that I'm not, I mean, the difference really is maybe the extensiveness of some of the more emotional aspects of my life that we're focused on, whether through the long arduous hours of interviews or just the archival stuff and I mean all that stuff. But for me, I felt it was fun to do. I mean, at moments when you're kind of like you want to focus on the ocean, they're like, oh, and by the way, we got to make sure the chopper and the boat and the guy and this can happen. But we've been doing that long enough, and I don't do it that much, especially as of lately, to make it like something that I'm not willing to participate in or that I'm not enjoying.
I have to say that Laird was really amazing, and I think, you know, approached this film like he approaches a very large wave, which is head on, even though I think parts of it were probably not so comfortable, including sitting down for, you know, probably a 12 or 13 hour interview. He doesn't really like to sit. He feels like the interview was more like 25 hours, so that's an internal debate that we have. But you know, and he handed over all of his archive, all of his photographs. He literally gave me his personal hard drive. He gave me his address book and said, you can call anybody you want, including family members and friends, some of whom were estranged, and said, I can ask anybody any question. And there was nothing off limits. So, you know, as a filmmaker, to really be able to delve into this story and have total and complete access is phenomenal and really enables one to you know, try to make the greatest film that is available.
There was one moment in the film, though, where you're talking about a near-death experience with you and your buddy. And you basically just, at that point, you told us a little bit about it, but then pulled back. And I didn't understand the reference that you were making. You didn't want his children to know about it? I mean, what was it that you didn't want us to know about that?
No, I didn't want to for Brett to not make it, and then I would have to explain to his wife and his family that, you know, why he wasn't coming home. Yeah. So that was the emotion that I had in the moment when we were dealing with that, you know, with the situation that we were in. It was like, you know, I don't want Brett to die. I mean, first of all, I don't want Brett to die anyway, but I don't want Brett to die. And I don't want to have to go and say, Shannon, I'm sorry, but, you know, Brett's gone, and McKenna, I'm sorry. Explain to his daughters and his wife that, you know, that he's dead.
Yeah.
So that unbelievable. That made me a little more strong.
Yeah. Talk to us. There was a reference, 50 to 60-foot waves. I heard one reference to 100. How big are these waves that you're riding?
Well, the day that Brett's talked about it, 80 to 100-foot waves, I mean, we call that 50-foot surf. So, you know, 50-foot surf can have 100-foot faces. I mean, the problem with waves and wave measurement in general is it's so, diverse and complicated, because you can go to Chopu in Tahiti, and the wave doesn't ever really get that tall, but the volume of water behind it. So, you know, you almost have to measure waves squared. You know, you have to kind of measure the thickness, the volume, the spectrum. I mean, there's all these different wave measuring scales. And so you never really, but yeah, I mean, we're talking, when we say 40 to 50 foot waves, we mean, you know, we can mean, you know, 80 or 100 foot faces.
And how fast are you going? I mean, because you've got the speed of the wave, and then you on top of it.
Yeah, well, we're you know, going over 50 miles an hour at times on a moving track, ultimately, that has, you know, moguls that can just pop up in front of you at any time. So it's not, you know, the speed isn't always, you know, people go 50 miles an hour on a smooth road. You can just look around, where when you're dealing with, you know, this is more like a video game, like you're ready for stuff to just jump out in front of you, and then you have to kind of, you know, respond to that stuff. And so the intensity of the emotion while you're doing it is it's as fast as you've ever been, you know. And I've flown with the Blue Angels. It's a different, you know, it demands your attention.
And what somebody may not know about you is that, I mean, here you are, like, I mean, that you've been described as the biggest, boldest, bravest, and best wave, big wave surfer in the world. And yet you have never competed.
Yes.
Because you just said, that's not for me. I'm not going to have somebody else tell me how good or not I am.
Yeah, well, you know, and I mean, I approach it a couple different ways. I mean, first of all, you know, my stepdad will tell you, you know, I don't like losing. Maybe I'm too competitive. Maybe I'm just so competitive that I don't want to subject myself to. First of all, I don't want to subject myself to a situation that I'm giving the outcome to someone else to control. I want to control it myself, and then I want to feel it. Like, I'll tell you if I feel like I succeeded or not, and then I'll subject my performance to an audience. I'll subject my performance and let the people decide, like an artist. You know, people can like your art or not like your art, but at the end, as an artist, you should feel good about your painting. Now, just because people don't like it doesn't mean that you're not fulfilled by your painting, you know. But at the same time, it is nice to have people enjoy your work. You know, as an artist, you feel like there's some validity when, you know, maybe I'm not out of my mind because I'm the only person that thinks it's great. It's nice when other people think, hey, that's, you know, we appreciate that.
Well, we don't have much more time, but I wanted to ask you about the music choices here. This is not Beach Boy music. Rory, that was your kind of a collaborative decision there?
Well, no, it was really my decision. Although, you know, Laird had some ideas for music, which I of course wanted to respect, but we ended up working with a fantastic composer named Nathan Larson, who wrote a lot of the music and scored the film. But in addition to that, we worked with this guy Randy, who is an extraordinary music supervisor. And he really helped us identify some amazing music to put in the film as well.
Well,
glad
you
liked it.
You had some compliments from some critics of friends of mine that were, first of all, impressed by the way it was ended in darkness, and then you didn't just kill the credits with some song that that has a tendency to happen and kind of distract people from really the conclusion of the film.
Yeah, well, it was hard, that last song, because any words would somehow seem reductive. But Randy Poster is a great and very well-known music supervisor and was terrific.
So this should be seen on the big screen because these are big waves. And is that going to happen?
That's our hope. We're here and we're hoping to link up with a distributor and get it out there in the world. And there seems to be a good amount of interest, so we're excited about that.
Well, congratulations. A fascinating film. I love watching it. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.